See you later, Teal, I called as I drove away. The end of the school day was the busiest I'd ever seen the town. I passed two people on Main Street and saw another four in a knot near the church. Some kind of an afternoon club, maybe. Reading the Bible or bottling peaches for the winter. I drove past them and hustled the big car up the sumptuous mile of Beckman Drive, turned in at the Hubble's white mailbox, and spun the old Bakelite steering wheel through the driveway curves. The problem with trying to warn Charlie was I didn't know how much I wanted to tell her. Certainly, I wasn't about to give her the details. Didn't even feel right to tell her Hubble was dead at all. We were stuck in some kind of a limbo. But I couldn't keep her in the dark forever. She needed to know some context, or else she wouldn't listen to the warning. I parked her car at her door and rang her bell. The children dashed around from somewhere as Charlie opened up and let me in. She was looking pretty tired and strained. The children looked happy enough. They hadn't picked up on their mother's worries. She chased them off, and I followed her back to the kitchen. It was a big, modern room. I got her to make me some coffee. I could see she was anxious to talk, but she was having trouble getting started. I watched her fiddling with the filter machine. "Don't you have a maid?" I asked her. She shook her head. "I don't want one," she said. "I like to do things myself." "It's a big house," I said.
"I like to keep busy, I guess," she said.
Then we were silent. Charlie switched on the coffee machine, and it started with a faint hiss. I sat at a table in a window nook. It overlooked an acre of velvet lawn. She came and sat opposite me, holding her hands in front of her.
"I heard about the Morrisons," she said at last. "Is my husband involved in all of this?"
I tried to think exactly what I could say to her. She waited for an answer. The coffee machine burbled away in the big, silent kitchen. "Yes, Charlie," I said. "I'm afraid he was. But he didn't want to be involved, okay? Some kind of blackmail was going on." She took it well. She must have figured it out for herself anyway. Must have run every possible speculation through her head. This explanation was the one which fit. That was why she didn't look surprised or outraged. She just nodded, then she relaxed. She looked like it had done her good to hear someone else say it. Now it was out in the open. It was acknowledged. It could be dealt with.
"I'm afraid that makes sense," she said.
She got up to pour the coffee, kept talking as she went.
"That's the only way I can explain his behavior," she said. "Is he in danger?"
"Charlie, I'm afraid I have no idea where he is," I said. She handed me a mug of coffee, sat down again on the kitchen counter.
"Is he in danger?"
she asked again. I couldn't answer. Couldn't get any words out. She moved off the counter and came to sit opposite me again at the table in the window. She cradled her cup in front of her. She was a fine-looking woman, blonde and pretty, perfect teeth, good bones, slim, athletic, a lot of spirit. I had seen her as a plantation type, what they call a belle. I had said to myself that 150 years ago she would have been a slave owner. I began to change that opinion. I felt a crackle of toughness coming from her. She enjoyed being rich and idle, sure. Beauty parlors and lunch with the girls in Atlanta, the Bentley and the gold cards, the big kitchen which cost more than I ever made in a year. But if it came to it, here was a woman who might get down in the dirt and fight. Maybe 150 years ago she would have been on a wagon train heading west. She had enough spirit. She looked hard at me across the table.
"I panicked this morning," she said. "That's not really like me at all. I must have given you a very bad impression, I'm afraid. After you left, I calmed down and thought things out. I came to the same conclusion you've just described. Hubs blundered into something, and he's got all tangled up in it. So what am I going to do about it? Well, I'm going to stop panicking and start thinking. I've been a mess since Friday, and I'm ashamed of it. That's not the real me at all. So I did something, and I hope you'll forgive me for it."
"Go on," I said.
"I called Dwight Stevenson," she said. He had mentioned he had seen a fax from the Pentagon about your service as a military policeman. I asked him to find it and read it to me. I thought it was an excellent record. She smiled at me, hitched her chair in closer. So what I want to do is hire you, she said. I want to hire you in a private capacity to solve my husband's problem. Would you consider doing that for me? Charlie smiled at me, hitched her chair in closer. So what I want to do is hire you, she said. I want to hire you in a private capacity to solve my husband's problem. Would you consider doing that for me? No, I said. I can't do that, Charlie. Can't or won't, she said. There would be a sort of a conflict of interest, I said. It might mean I couldn't do a proper job for you. A conflict, she said. In what way? I paused for a long moment, tried to figure out how to explain it. Your husband felt bad, okay? I said. He got hold of some kind of an investigator, a government guy, and they were trying to fix the situation. But the government guy got killed, and I'm afraid my interest is in the government guy more than your husband. She followed what I was saying and nodded. But why? She asked. You don't work for the government. The government guy was my brother, I told her. Just a crazy coincidence, I know, but I'm stuck with it. She went quiet. She saw where the conflict could lie. I'm very sorry, she said. You're not saying Hub betrayed your brother? No, I said. That's the very last thing he would have done. He was depending on him to get him out from under. Something went wrong is all. May I ask you a question? She said. Why do you refer to my husband in the past tense? I looked straight at her. Because he's dead, I said. I'm very sorry. Charlie hung in there. She went pale and clenched her hands until her knuckles shone waxy white, but she didn't fall apart. I don't think he's dead, she whispered. I would know. I would be able to feel it. I think he's just hiding out somewhere. I want you to find him. I'll pay you whatever you want. I just slowly shook my head at her. Please, she said. I won't do it, Charlie, I said. I won't take your money for that. I would be exploiting you. I can't take your money because I know he's already dead. I'm very sorry, but there it is. There was a long silence in the kitchen. I sat there at the table, nursing the coffee she'd made for me. Would you do it if I didn't pay you? She said. Maybe you could just look around for him while you find out about your brother. I thought about it. Couldn't see how I could say no to that. Okay, I said. I'll do that, Charlie. But like I say, don't expect miracles. I think we're looking at something very bad here. I think he's alive, she said. I would know if he wasn't. I started worrying about what would happen when his body was found. She was going to come face to face with reality the same way a runaway truck comes face to face with the side of a building. You'll need expense money, Charlie said. I wasn't sure about taking it, but she passed me a thick envelope. Will that do? She asked. I looked in the envelope. There was a thick wad of $100 bills in there. I nodded. That would do. And please keep the car, she said. Use it as long as you need it. I nodded again, thought about what else I needed to say, and forced myself to use the present tense. Where does he work? I asked her. Sunrise International, she said. It's a bank. She reeled off an Atlanta address. Okay, Charlie, I said. Now let me ask you something else. It's very important. Did your husband ever use the word pluribus? She thought about it and shrugged. Pluribus, she said. Isn't that something to do with politics? Like, on the podium when the president gives a speech? I never heard Hub talking about it. He graduated in banking studies. You never heard him use that word? I asked her again. Not on the phone, not in his sleep or anything?
Never,
she said. What about next Sunday? I asked her. Did he mention next Sunday? Anything about what's going to happen?
Next Sunday, she repeated. I don't think he mentioned it. Why? What's going to happen next Sunday?
I don't know, I said. That's what I'm trying to find out. She pondered it again for a long moment, but just shook her head and shrugged, palms upward, like it meant nothing to her.
I'm sorry, she said.
Don't worry about it, I said. Now you've got to do something.
What do I have to do?
She said. You've got to get out of here, I said. Her knuckles were still white, but she was staying in control.
I've got to run and hide, she said.
But where to? An FBI agent is coming here to pick you up, I said. She stared at me in panic.
FBI,
she said. She went paler still.
This is really serious, isn't it?
It's deadly serious, I said. You need to get ready to leave right now.
Okay,
she said slowly.
I can't believe this is happening.
I walked out of her kitchen and into the garden room where we had drunk iced tea the day before, stepped through the French doors and strolled a slow circuit outside the house, down the driveway, through the banks of greenery out onto Beckman Drive, leaned up on the white mailbox on the shoulder. It was silent. I could hear nothing at all except the dry rustle of the grass cooling under my feet. Then I could hear a car coming west out of town. It slowed just before the crest of the rise, and I heard the automatic box slur a change down as the speed dropped. The car rose up over the crest into view. It was a brown Buick, very plain, two guys in it. They were small, dark guys, Hispanic, loud shirts. They were slowing, drifting to the left of the road, looking for the Hubble mailbox. I was leaning on the Hubble mailbox, looking at them. Their eyes met mine. The car accelerated again and swerved away, blasted on into the empty peach country. I stepped out and watched them go. I saw a dust plume rising as they drove off Margrave's immaculate blacktop onto the dusty rural roadway. Then I sprinted back up to the house. I wanted Charlie to hurry. She was inside, flustered, chattering away like a kid going on vacation, making lists out loud, some kind of a mechanism to burn off the panic she was feeling. On Friday, she'd been a rich, idle woman married to a banker. Now, on Monday, a stranger who said the banker was dead was telling her to hurry up and run for her life. "Take the mobile phone with you," I called to her. She didn't reply. I just heard a worried silence. Footsteps and closet doors banging. I sat in her kitchen with the rest of the coffee for most of an hour. Then I heard a car horn blow and the crunch of heavy steps on the gravel. A loud knock on the front door. I put my hand in my pocket and closed it around the ebony handle of Morrison's switchblade, walked out into the hallway, and opened up. There was a neat blue sedan next to the Bentley and a gigantic black guy standing back from the doorstep. He was as tall as me, maybe even taller, but he must have outweighed me by at least 100 pounds. Must have been 310, 320. Next to him, I was a featherweight. He stepped forward with the easy, elastic grace of an athlete.
"Reacher," the giant said. "Pleased to meet you. I'm Picard, the FBI.
He shook hands with me. He was enormous. He had a casual competence about him which made me glad he was on my side. He looked like my type of a guy, like he could be very useful in a tight corner. I suddenly felt a flood of encouragement. I stood aside to let him into Charlie's house.
"Okay," Picard said to me. "I got all the details from Finley. Real sorry about your brother, my friend. Real sorry. Somewhere we can talk?"
I led him through to the kitchen. He loped beside me and covered the distance in a couple of strides, glanced around and poured himself the dregs of the stewed coffee. Then he stepped over next to me and dropped his hand on my shoulder. Felt like somebody had hit me with a bag of cement.
"Ground rules," he said. "This whole thing is off the record, right?"
I nodded. His voice matched his bulk. It was a low rumble. It was what a brown bear would sound like if it learned to talk. I couldn't tell how old the guy was. He was one of those big, fit men whose peak years stretch on for decades. He nodded and moved away, rested his giant frame against the counter.
"This is a huge problem for me," he said. "Bureau can't act without a call from the responsible official in the local jurisdiction. That would be this guy Teal, right? And from what Finley tells me, I assume old Teal's not going to make that call. so I could end up with my big ass in a sling for this. But I'll bend the rules for Finley. We go back quite a ways. But you got to remember, this is all unofficial. Okay?
I nodded again. I was happy with that. Very happy. Unofficial help suited me fine. It would get the job done without hanging me up on procedure. I had 5 clear days before Sunday. This morning, 5 days had seemed more than generous. But now, with Hubble gone, I felt like I was very short of time, much too short of time to waste any of it on procedure.
Where are you going to put them? I asked him.
Safe house up in Atlanta, Picard said. Bureau place. We've had it for years. They'll be secure there, but I'm not going to say exactly where it is. And I'm going to have to ask you not to press Mrs. Hubble about it afterward, okay? I got to watch my back on this thing. I blow a safe house, I'm in really deep shit.
Okay, Picard, I said. I won't cause you a problem, and I appreciate it.
He nodded, gravely, like he was way out on a limb. Then Charlie and the kids burst in. They were burdened down with badly packed bags. Picard introduced himself. I could see that Charlie's daughter was terrified by the size of the guy. The little boy's eyes grew round as he gazed at the FBI special agent's shield Picard was holding out. Then the 5 of us carried the bags outside and piled them in the blue sedan's trunk. I shook hands with Picard and Charlie, then they all got in the car. Picard drove them away. I waved after them.